here joining us now to discuss. Keith Lerner, he's the chief market strategist over at Truist Wealth. Keith, always great to have you on the program. Let's start with kind of the setup here for growth names, and of course at the center of that is going to be technology, sort of an under the surface, maybe a stealth weakening, but you look at the move in semis the last couple of days, I don't think it's so stealth anymore. There is certainly a cooling off in that growth in tech trade.
Well, first, Miles, always great to be with you and the crew, and a good way to end the week. So as far as technology, what you mentioned, the cyclical trade, we've seen this rotation from month to month, back and forth, back and forth. And our view is the recent rotation back into tech has gone too far, and we think it's unlikely that we're going to see the tech outperformance near term. And you've highlighted a couple of things. One of the main things we've been discussing is the move up we've seen in tech, or the outperformance since May, was really sentiment driven, meaning valuations expanded, but the earnings compared to the broader market have actually been weaker as a whole. And then you pair that with some technical trends. You mentioned one, semiconductors on a relative price basis have started to roll over. You're seeing the average stock, right, if you remove some of those big mega cap tech stocks, actually have been weakening for some time. So our main point is we do not see tech as leadership. That doesn't mean there's not some select opportunities, but we like other areas such as financials and some of the economically sensitive areas that have actually underperformed the last few months.
So, Keith, at the top of the show, we mentioned that this is the 47th time this year that the S&P 500 has closed a record. But if tech's not going to participate, can that keep happening?
Well, I do think there will be areas of tech that do participate, especially more on the mega cap side. We just don't think that their leadership. But to your question, yes, we do think that the market can continue to move higher. But you're likely to see more of the bigger moves below the surface because tech is such a big part of the overall market. And then for folks that are interested in the tech side, I would say that we're more interested in the communication services. And we saw some of the results, as you guys discussed overnight, in the media side as a whole. But yeah, I just think it's going to be the bigger action is going to be below the surface.
Keith, Disney out with earnings, saying they're seeing some group cancellations. Business overall pretty good. Airbnb warning on its next coming quarter because of the COVID Delta variant. Should investors be paying more attention to this? Shouldn't stock prices be coming off their highs just a little bit to account for some of this uncertainty?
Yeah, Brian, I would say they already have. If you think about some of these areas that you just mentioned, I mean, some of the airlines and restaurants, they're down 15 or 20% off their highs. The other interesting point is we've seen a lot of liquidation out of the cyclical sector. So early on this year, everyone was bulled up and everyone was on the same side of the boat, huge inflows. And over the last 3 months, we've seen pretty significant outflows across the board in these cyclical areas. The other point is markets look forward. And first of all, the valuations for some of these areas have become more attractive. And it's preliminary, but what we're starting to see, like the seven-day average as far as new COVID cases, tentatively, looks like it's starting to peak. So again, if the market's looking forward, which we think it is, and these numbers actually get better by the end of the year, I think a lot of these cyclical areas already reflect some of that slowdown.
And, you know, Keith, against all this, of course, we have the index. You know, the index level is still trading at a record high, and we continue to see the index itself held up by these rotational forces that, you know, have pretty much continued smoothly through these periods of instability. Is there a risk in your mind that, you know, perhaps this clean, I guess I could call it a clean shift of preference for growth to value and then back again? Is there a potential that this gets upset and then we finally see, you know, a pullback of 5% or something, which we have not seen, of course, I think in more than 180 some odd trading days?
Yeah, no, this is the second longest period without a 5% pullback of the last decade. And we're also in a seasonally, historically weak period. So far, the market's been able to shake that off. To answer your question more directly, the answer is yes. I mean, we can go back over the last 40 years, and there's only been about 2 years where we have not seen at least a 5% pullback. But the big picture, though, and what we reminded folks during this bull market is we are in a bull market, and our focus is on the next 12 months. And if we still think we're in a multi-year bull market, we're more interested in participating in the next 30, 40, 50%. And the 5% pullbacks are the admission price to the market. And it reminds me of a quote that you all may be familiar with from Peter Lynch. And he said that there's been more money lost anticipating the correction than the correction itself.
Yeah, that's a good one, Keith.
Yeah, that's why. Keith, that's why I always like to say that bear markets are bad because everybody loses money. You know, just because a couple smart guys put a few hedges on doesn't mean that that's enough for everybody. All right, we'll leave it there. Keith Lerner, Chief Market Strategist at Truist Wealth. Keith, have a great weekend. I know we'll be in touch.
Well, Disney shares trading higher after the company's earnings report beat estimates, talked about strength in streaming that was better than estimated, and strength especially in its parks business. Now all of its parks are once again open. Tim Manolin is joining us now, senior media analyst at Macquarie, who covers the stock. Tim, thanks for being here. I want to start on the parks because I'm still really intrigued by the company's commentary around what's happening right now, in that they don't really seem to be seeing a drop in demand as a result of the Delta variant. What do you make of that? I mean, I think Miles referred to Disney as Teflon higher up in the show. Is that how you view them?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? They actually said that their attendance levels were higher than the same quarter 2 years ago before COVID, and per capita spending is higher, and the demand is only growing from here. I would put it down to, clearly pent-up demand amongst consumers having been locked up in their homes for a year and a half. But, think about the brand affinity that people have for Disney, and I guess the trust that people put in Disney. I mean, they're quality parks. People are trusting that they're clean and they're well-maintained, and they seem like good places to go with the family. I think we do need to be aware of the Delta variant and what that may yet mean. I think most of the companies I follow have given guidance, but said this depends on things not getting worse with the Delta variant. So we'll see what happens there. But Disney certainly seems optimistic.
Tim, I'm looking at your model in your note you put out this morning. So you're looking for adjusted earnings for 2022 for Disney to go to about $5.06, up from an estimated $2.26 this year. Why are you so confident on that large bump in earnings for Disney?
Sure. A lot of it is the cyclical rebound, clearly. Parks were largely shut for much of the first part of the year. They only turned a profit, and literally just barely, by $2 million in the U.S. parks just now in the calendar second quarter, Disney's fiscal third quarter. So as that demand comes flowing back, it's really just a matter of the operating leverage that they get, having already rehired most of their temporary staff in the parks. So most of the cost has now flowed back on, and you've got all the revenues coming back in, again, assuming that the variant doesn't upset things. But it's really largely about the flow back for parks, somewhat for box office, and also for advertising revenue, both in the linear and the streaming businesses, which have been very, very strong this year. Next year gets to be a bit more normalized without the heavy sports costs comparison from this year. So you get a lot of operating profit benefit going into next year, into a hopefully more normal year.
Tim, as part of your modeling, is your expectation that Disney Plus finally turns a profit next year?
Not next year. I have to double check what we actually have. I think it's another year after that or so. They did a pretty remarkable job, I think, narrowing the losses at Disney Plus in the most recent quarter reported yesterday. It was about half the losses for the direct-to-consumer businesses. But there's still a lot of launching going on in different countries, Japan, Korea, Latin America with Star Plus, and then Eastern Europe next year. So a number of launches yet to come. A lot of content investments. Still, remember, a lot of the content production was stalled for several months. Now that is coming back. And once the content hits the platform, that's when they start to amortize the cost. And there's a lot of marketing going on. Disney Plus is going to have its Disney Plus Day on the anniversary of the two-year anniversary of the launch, November 12th. So a lot of marketing as well. So I think the costs remain fairly heavy yet for the intermediate period this year and next year, getting toward break-even maybe in a couple of years or so.
Tim, I'm curious about the movie business. They got one question on the call last night about obviously the highly public spat that the company has entered into with Scarlett Johansson. And I'm just curious from an analyst standpoint, if that poses a risk maybe to how you think about the movie business going forward? Or is it right now a story just about streaming, about the parks recovery, and the movie stuff can be, you know, more of a Hollywood, you know, industry story, less so than maybe a Wall Street one?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good characterization. Although, you know, film is an important aspect of Disney's business model. Well, you know, the industry is in great change right now, as with the TV industry. The changes have come to film a little bit more suddenly, a little bit more recently. And I think Disney, along with some of its peers in the film studio business that have their own streaming services, are now doing the experimentation to see what can they get in terms of sales and ultimate profitability by putting their film content onto their direct-to-consumer platforms. It's still very much an experiment, a work in progress. But if you think about it, the film industry, like the TV industry, may not have the same as good economics going forward as they have had in the past. There might be more cost involved in developing the product. Then you've got all of the streaming services you have to support, and you're foregoing some of the revenues, whether it's in the box office or in the windows, to support those streaming services, potentially at lower margins. Disney remains optimistic that they can do well with this, but it's going to take some time to sort of sort out, you know, how the ultimate economics work.
And, you know, you mentioned television. And so obviously you think about where the ESPN asset is at in its life cycle. ESPN has remained pretty aggressive in acquiring sports rights. I mean, I don't think live is really moving away from that asset, but they're trying to get more people onto ESPN Plus. And I'm curious how you think about that as part of the portfolio. I mean, it's 6 years ago now, but, you know, that was such a big part of the Disney story back, I think it was 14 or 15, when, you know, you started to really see that subscription decline. Where does ESPN fit in now for you guys?
Oof. I mean, that's an even harder question than the film one, but it's a similar one in that consumer habits are changing. The platforms are in place to enable consumers to stream content from their devices wherever they are. And the entire industry, therefore, is changing here. Disney made, I think, a very smart preemptive move to set up ESPN Plus as a sort of alternative service. Of course, remember, nothing that's on ESPN, you know, whether it's, you know, the Major League Baseball, you know, game that night or NBA or whatever the game might be, is going to be on ESPN Plus in your local area yet. There will be some NFL rights that come on in a couple of years' time and that new contract starts. But I think what Disney is doing, again, is experimenting here, seeing what they can learn in terms of consumer behavior, in terms of the data that they can collect, and ultimately in terms of what kind of profit they can make on a streaming business. I still don't think the pieces are all in place yet in sports to really go fully fledged onto streaming. But they're now incorporating streaming rights into new sports contracts. One day, it will be, I think, a completely over-the-top streaming sports environment. But pricing to the consumer, the price that the networks can afford to pay the leagues for the content, all of that is still being, you know, learned and understood. So it is coming. It will happen. We're taking steps toward that, but we're not there yet.
Tim, good to see you. Thanks for chatting with us this morning. Tim Nolan, Senior Media Analyst at Macquarie.
Impossible Foods is going toe-to-toe with Big Sausage. The plant-based meat company has just unveiled ground sausage in a bid to grab breakfast goers. Let's chew on this more with Impossible Foods President Dennis Woodside. Dennis, good to see you this morning here. Two questions.
Great to see
you. Why sausage? Yeah, why sausage? And when I go into a supermarket, where will this be positioned?
To completely replace the need for animal-based food, animal agriculture. And we've gone after the cow successfully. Now we're coming after the pig. The sausage is a huge market. It's about a $10 billion market in the U.S. alone. And for us to fulfill our mission, we got to compete with the pig.
And Dennis, is this just resigned to the supermarket aisles? Will we see this with some of your food service partners?
Oh, yeah. So currently, Starbucks is serving the Impossible Breakfast Sandwich, one of the most popular breakfast sandwiches in America, and that is the sausage product. You're going to find this product all over grocery stores. We're already in thousands of stores with sausage. And the thing about it that's amazing, it's actually far better than the animal product on every dimension. From a nutritional standpoint, it has about 30% fewer calories, about 47% less fat, no cholesterol whatsoever. And we did a blind taste test with a couple hundred consumers where we gave them the leading animal-based sausage and we gave them our product. Two out of three on a blind basis chose Impossible over the animal. So, you know, if we can provide products that taste delicious and are nutritious and are better for consumers, they're going to migrate to them. And we're going to be everywhere. We're going to be in both the fresh aisle and the frozen aisle with this product.
Hey, Dennis, it's Julie here. Got to ask the sodium question. How does it come? I mean, obviously, you know, when you're talking about meat that doesn't have any seasoning on it, it's not really apples to apples. But a typical packaged sausage product, how does that compare?
It's, you know, it's slightly higher in sodium, but it's the animal sausage actually has quite a bit of sodium in it. So we're slightly higher, but not materially.
And Dennis, it's Miles here. I want to ask a little bit about pricing just for this product, but pricing across the space. You know, we've seen a lot of entrants, you know, coming in. There's a lot of competition in the growing alternative meat category. And just, you know, have you been taking down your price and being able to take price? Where is it fitting into, you know, the overall grocery environment today?
Yeah. So for us to compete with the pig, we got to price like the pig eventually. Now we're new to the market and the animal industry has had 100 years to scale their supply chain and drive costs down. As we scale up, our costs are going to come down as well. We lowered price twice in the last roughly 20 months by 20% and 15%. So as we scale up, as our production lines get more full, we run three shifts, we can pass costs along to the consumer.
And Dennis, speaking of the cost that you might need to pass on to the consumer, how's that going in terms of supply chain, right? This particular product, I believe, is soy-based. First of all, what have you seen in input costs? And second of all, about getting it, because I don't know if you've had issues recently, but I know you and some of your rivals going back a couple of years had some troubles getting enough of what you needed to make your products.
Yeah, so we've scaled up our supply chain massively in the last couple of years. Our manufacturing capacity has increased by about 10x over the last 2 years. And we've secured multiple partners that help us scale, help us bring on new capacity when we see spikes in demand. So we haven't had any issues recently. You may find when you go to the store, sometimes we're stocked out. And a lot of times that's because the retailer isn't used to the product and hasn't gotten in the habit of predicting demand. But we have not had any issues ourselves. We haven't had any issues with COVID either affecting our supply chain. As far as pricing, we've locked in our pricing for most ingredients for multiple years. So the short-term swings in the commodity market don't really affect us.
Dennis, why is it Impossible a public company yet?
Well, we've been able to grow with private financing and we will continue to grow, you know, organically without the need currently for going public. Our CEO and founder, Pat Brown, you know, he has said this is inevitably going to be a public company someday. But right now, you know, we have the funds that we need to continue to expand the business. So there's no need.
Fair enough. Good luck in your battle with Big Pig. Impossible Foods President Dennis Woodside. Good to see you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Information and records company Equifax shares earlier this week were trading at a record. The company also announced an acquisition, Appriss Insights, for about $1.8 billion. This is actually a prison records business. And to talk a little bit more about that and the business generally, joining us is Equifax CEO Mark Begor. Mark, thank you for being here. So first of all, talk us through that acquisition. I have to admit, very frankly, prison records is not something that I've ever thought about, even really thought about existing. What are they for? How do they fit into your business?
Sure. You know, data is really at the heart of who Equifax is. You know, we're a 122-year-old company, but we're really in the early chapters of remaking the company to be much more than a credit bureau. And that really leads you into additional data assets. And, you know, we have a vast trove of very differentiated data assets. With regards to Appriss, they have very unique data that's used in the background screening process when someone's hired. know, for example, in the United States, 75 million people will get new jobs this year or change jobs. And as a part of that hiring process, hiring company will spend, $4,000 to $5,000 around, checking on that individual. One of the checks is around where did they work before? And we have data at that at scale. We have a data set that's very unique to Equifax in our income and employment database that has records on over 119 million unique records. So we have background on, many Americans and where they worked. So that's one thing that's checked in the background screening process. Another is, have you been in jail before? Is a very important attribute to keep workplaces safe in order to use in the hiring process. It's also used in the government services area. The delivery of social services is another big $2 billion TAM, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, SNAP, food stamp benefits, those kind of benefits. Same thing, they use our data to determine does someone qualify from an income standpoint. And then the second is you're not eligible for those benefits if you're incarcerated. So that data is very valuable. So our focus is really on bringing new data sets to the business. This is our eighth acquisition of the year for a total of about $3 billion. So a very large commitment to expanding Equifax and diversifying Equifax and a real focus on bringing differentiated data sets into the business.
As it pertains to this acquisition, Mark, is this a higher margin business compared to what you have been acquiring?
Yeah, it's actually our industry's high margin, as you probably know. The industry broadly grows in the high single digits with margins that are call it in the high 30s. So very attractive cash flow generating industry and business. This business in particular is a faster growing business than the rest of Equifax. So it's accretive to our revenue growth rates. We see some meaningful synergies, in bringing it on board. And it also has margins that are accretive to Equifax. And it's actually plugging into our largest business at Equifax. We call it Workforce Solutions. That's where this income and employment data is housed. And that business is about 40% of Equifax and is actually growing 50% faster than the rest of Equifax. And the margins in Workforce Solutions, which APRIS will become a part of, are about 50% higher than the rest of Equifax. So it's highly accretive as a business for Equifax. And we're really in the early chapters of remaking a 122-year-old company that most people think about as a credit bureau. And Equifax is much more than just credit data today, as evidenced by the APRIS acquisition, by our Count acquisition earlier this year, where we bought identity and fraud data. And we're really going down the path of turning Equifax into more of a data analytics technology company. The last 3 years, we spent over $1.5 billion, which is a lot for a $4.8 billion revenue company, incrementally to take our technology to the cloud. And by moving to the cloud, we think we're better positioned to deliver data to our customers quickly in a always-on capability. And that's also driving our financial results. If you look at overall Equifax, historically, as I said, we would have been growing in the high single digits. Last year, we grew 18%. Through the first half, we're up 26%. So really a strong multiple to where we were performing before. That's driven off the cloud. It's driven off our acquisitions. But it's also giving us the financial resources with the strong cash generation with those kind of margins to reinvest in those bolt-on acquisitions that'll strengthen Equifax for the future.
The mortgage part of your business has been under pressure. Can you explain to us what is happening in that market right now and how will that progress looking out over the next 12 months?
Yeah, I would use a small term on under pressure. The mortgage market's still very strong. It's at record levels today. It's a large part of our business. It's about 30% of Equifax. Actually, with the acquisitions we're making in what I would call the non-mortgage space, we're actually going to go from 30% to something closer to 25% in the future. That diversification we think is attractive. But with low interest rates that we're still experiencing, there's a big market for refinancings and cash out refinancings that are driving our business in the mortgage space. And then we also use that income and employment data. So when someone either applies for a new home mortgage or for a refi on a mortgage, they not only pull their credit file, which is good for Equifax, but they also have to verify their income and employment. Is Mark working and how much does he make as a part of that decisioning process? So that's been very positive, for Equifax and been fueling you know, some of that strong growth, but we're also growing in the other verticals across Equifax, whether it's auto, personal loans, credit cards, but then outside of financial services, we have a large employee benefits business where we provide services to HR managers around W-2, I-9, you know, other regulatory services. And then we also have, as I mentioned earlier, a fast-growing business in the hiring space or talent solutions. That's a $5 billion TAM, and we're seeing very strong growth there. And really what employers are focused on today in this really competitive market to source and hire new people is how do I shorten that time frame between making an offer and doing whatever background screening or other checks I'm going to do and get that individual on the floor, in the factory, in the store. And our data and the Appriss acquisition aids in that, giving an instantaneous set of data to make that decision is very valuable. And then, of course, I mentioned also in government services. Government services have been growing. As you know, there's discussions in Washington to advance those further. Those all require some level of verification of income and employment, meaning do you qualify? And then, of course, Appriss plays into that because they're not permitted, you know, if you're, you know, being incarcerated currently. So it's really around the explosion of data that's driving, you know, our top line and bottom line, and of course, very strong cash flow margins.
And Mark, real quickly before we let you go, are you seeing the economy slow down to a significant degree? Because everything we're seeing with the COVID-19 Delta variant, I mean, I imagine you have a very good read on this, given your access to all this credit data we give.
We're not. As you saw from the numbers we delivered last year, you know, in the heat of COVID, you know, being up 18% was very, very strong. You know, it was a record year for Equifax, and it was the power of data. And then even up more strongly at up 28%, you know, through the first half. You know, we're seeing financial institutions are very strong, meaning they didn't have the losses that were anticipated a year ago from COVID because of the stimulus payments. Consumers are strong. You know, their balance sheets are strong. They've had the benefits of those stimulus payments. They've actually been paying down some of their credit card loans, their mortgages, et cetera. And now when you see the economy coming back and people working again, the core of our business is very, very strong. As you see, financial institutions, the hiring process, social services from government, you know, are really, you know, quite strong for us. And it goes back to the power of data. You know, more data results in better decisions, and we're focused on expanding our data sets really to be much more than a credit bureau going forward. And our strong operations are really allowing us to make these kind of acquisitions. The $3 billion in acquisitions that we've announced so far in 2021 is up about 6x of our historical path. We're committed to, you know, investing in Equifax for the future.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Mark Begor is the Equifax CEO. Have a great weekend, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Welcome back. I want to dig a little bit deeper into Airbnb's earnings here. The company handedly topping expectations in its latest quarter, as you can see, but its guidance for the current quarter might have investors a little spooked. Let's start with the good news there. Reporting a near quadrupling of revenue in Q2 as travel bounced back from the lows of the pandemic. The company also, as you can see, they reported a narrower than expected net loss. But for Q3, Airbnb says it expects the number of nights and experiences booked to fall short of where they were pre-pandemic back in 2019. So for more on how that's impacting the growth story for Airbnb as shares move between red and green here, let's bring in Bernie McTernan, Needham & Company Managing Director, joins us right now. And Bernie, you seem unfazed here based on that potential Q3 slowdown. You reiterated your buy rating, upped your price target $6 a share to $200. So what makes this a buying opportunity in your eyes?
Yeah, look, we're willing to take the long-term view. I mean, what we did is that we took up our bookings estimate for the year by 10%, our revenue estimate up by 8%, and our EBITDA estimate by almost 40%. So really, our two key takeaways from the print is that North America is just still really strong. So if you look sequential or versus 2019 levels, North America was up 29% or 25% on nights booked. So certainly good to see demand coming back in their most important territory, but then also supply is coming back too. This is the first quarter since the pandemic started where supply actually increased increased sequentially. And there's two things really driving that. One, supply is following demand. So on that point on North America strength, North America supply was actually up 8% sequentially. So really good to see. And then number two, the company's been investing in efficiency. So they talked about how the onboarding of a host is actually half of the time now than it was prior to some of the efficiencies that they've put in. And they're also advertising too, the big digital advertising campaign in 2Q to bring hosts back on. So those are really our key takeaways in terms of the momentum in the story. Obviously, the warning on July brings up a whole lot of uncertainty, but we heard that earlier in the week too, and last week from Expedia and Booking as well.
On the particular cost you just highlighted, I mean, 175% jump, and Airbnb has said, look, we're trying to expand our platform. We're trying to get more hosts on board here. I mean, is that the only story here, or do you think that they're sort of struggling because of the pandemic? How should we read into that 175% jump?
Well, this is a company that's going to be coming out of the pandemic a whole lot more profitable than before. We actually increased our EBITDA estimates. Now we're above $1 billion in EBITDA for 2021, and we're above $2 billion in 2022. Why that's so significant is because the two major pushbacks I get on the stock is one, supply, and I already talked about the good parts in supply there, but two is on valuation. This is a stock trading at 15 times sales, which is pretty expensive, but we think that stock is on the brink of going through a valuation paradigm shift here, where, as I mentioned before, the over $2 billion of EBITDA we have for 2022, that's at the high end of the street. But the stock's trading at 40 to 45 times that number. So we think that the stock, as they continue to beat, it's going to go through the shift where it's going to look expensive on sales. So all of a sudden, that time to reasonableness, where you can put a reasonable multiple on like an NTM EBITDA number, is coming a lot closer. And that's how we'll be looking at the stock going forward.
Yeah, I wonder how maybe that the idea that can happen maybe gets dented here in terms of just kind of the weakness that came up for Q3. Not because, you know, it's not something dissimilar from what other people are reporting too. You know, we had the CEO of Booking Holdings on the show not too long ago, also talking about some Q3 weakness relative to pre-pandemic travel. But just because Airbnb is so new, right? I mean, maybe investors just don't totally understand that this company is not just kind of a hotel company or competitor, but also the experiences that are added on top of it. I mean, what do you think maybe other analysts might be missing?
Yeah, well, I think a key point here is that travel really changed during the pandemic. It became less urban, it was shorter distances, it was more domestic, and it was longer stays. That really drove consumers to maybe try Airbnb for the first time. And now we're seeing some of those pockets actually come back on the inverse. So we're seeing, you know, cross-border travel start to increase. We're start seeing cities start to increase. So I think that some of the strains where they're the only game in town maybe during the pandemic getting consumers to try Airbnb, that's drawing consumers in. We actually did a survey about a month ago where customers or U.S. consumers said that on average, as they traveled over the next year, half the people said they were going to stay in a hotel and half said they were going to try an Airbnb. But if you had stayed at an Airbnb before, it was actually half hotels and half Airbnbs. That tells us that really the gating factor for people to stay in an Airbnb is to try it for the first time. And because travel is changed during the pandemic, we think it did drive people to try it for the first time.
And Bernie, you know, before we came to you, we were talking about Disney as one of those stocks where you can sort of play the reopening as well as the stay-at-home trade on both ends. I mean, couldn't you argue that Airbnb is kind of one of those stocks? On the one hand, the uncertainty around the Delta variant raises concerns about how willing people are to travel. But then when you look at the most recent quarter, they've highlighted the fact that the longer stays, 28 days or more, is the fastest growing sector. Does it make Airbnb a bit more resilient when you compare it to some of its competitors in the travel space?
Maybe relative to the rest of the travel space. I mean, if you know, if we go through another massive wave here and we're still talking about the Delta variant, you know, 6 to 12 months from now, it's going to be hard for the stock to work over that time frame if there's a significant kind of, you know, re-shutdown. But unless, you know, if that, you know, doesn't be the scene, you know, we're looking at a company that's coming out of the pandemic a whole lot more profitable. And we think that's really just not understood by investors at this point to the degree that we think it is.
Bernie McTernan, Needham and Company Managing Director. Good to talk to you on this Friday. Have a good weekend.
The housing market remains red hot as home prices grew by the double digits in metro areas. Now, that's all according to a report from the National Association of Realtors. So let's discuss that. We're joined now by Lawrence Yu, National Association of Realtors Chief Economist. Great to have you here with us, Lawrence. I feel like I get this question a lot, and so I'm going to pose it to you, as so many folks out there right now are trying to buy a home and finding that, frankly, a lot of them are unaffordable. They can't afford some of these home prices. And the biggest question I always get is why? So can you explain to us right now why we are seeing some of these home prices growing, as the report is finding, by the double digits in some cities?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. The past 12 months has been quite exceptional. Nothing like this in terms of 20% price appreciation in a single year. And this is happening in 90% of the metro markets. So it's not a one or two city phenomena. It is a nationwide phenomena. Why? Well, the mortgage rate hitting all-time low. So it was simply too good to pass up for some home buyers. But we have to remember, we had a housing shortage before the pandemic, and the shortage simply exacerbated during the pandemic. So you had a strong demand, lack of supply. Well, what popped out was home prices. Now, that's a great news for homeowners, but a tremendous challenge for potential first-time buyers.
Well, and then I want to follow up on that. If home prices are so elevated, we've seen some of the numbers for new home sales, existing sales. We've seen those come off their peaks by quite a wide margin. Is it simply the case that high housing prices are the cure for high housing prices? And then where do you see these numbers leveling off in the future?
Well, the price increases, again, due to the housing shortage. But because of the price increases, now it is deterring buyers, especially the first-time buyers who have to come up with fresh down payment. Now, the trade-off buyers have no problem with that down payment as they sell their home, have the equity. So it's still about the first-time buyers. So home sales have been coming down, both existing and new, but it is still running ahead of the pre-pandemic condition, but it is no longer that huge surge. And way to fix it is we have to have more supply. We need to assure that the builders can build more, possibly even utilizing some of the tax credit or existing tax benefits like 1031 exchange to produce more home. Now, I use a little jargon, but essentially we want to assure that there are incentives to build more homes because this is the only way to assure that the first-time buyers see more moderate prices, price leveling out, and give some chance for the income to catch up.
Do you view this as a bubble at all, Lawrence?
Oh, I'm not concerned with any price decline because, you know, when we look at 15 years ago, you look at the supply situation where it was over 10 months supply, which means that it would take about 10 months to exhaust the inventory. Today, we are at 2-3 months supply, extremely tight inventory condition. And even though some of the frenzy activity has now disappear. Now, the some cases, we still have multiple offers, but less intense multiple offer situation now. So it's really a question about the leveling up in the prices. And fortunately, we don't have those risky subprime lending, which is a good thing to assure that housing market is on firm footing.
Yeah, and we don't have tanning salon managers managing an inventory of five investment properties. I want to get your view on the very long term, the secular term. Let's think out to the end of the decade here. We have millennials now entering the market as they have been for several years. Are we in a secular bull market in housing? Because I've interviewed several people who say we are. In fact, we might have some cyclical downturns, but over the next 10 years, they're seeing prices rising for the most part. What camp are you in?
So, in a short term, anything can happen over the short term, but over the long haul, America is one of the few countries, few advanced countries to see population increase. Last year was one of the slowest population increase of only 2 million, but that's still adding to housing demand. And we are not even sufficiently supplying to even adequately address 2 million new people, but we should anticipate that population will be rising. The supply situation is still very restrictive, and this will not open up quickly. I mean, it's going to take several years. So someone who is buying a real estate today, I think they should feel comfortable that the prices will be certainly higher. Perhaps it's a more moderate growth in the upcoming years. And another factor is inflation. Anytime consumer price inflation begins to be much higher than normal, real estate tends to be a very good hedge against inflation. And that's another motivator as to why people are buying.
Curious to know what you see right now, perhaps as a catalyst that could serve to really cool this market a little bit. Is there anything out there that you're seeing that could be a risk to the housing market? Well, to its strength, I should say.
The driver for the current activity is the low mortgage rates. Now, pandemic has led to greater demand in the suburbs and smaller town and away from the high density downtown area. So we have seen that shift, but it's the low interest rate that has really provided. So what happens if interest rates were to rise? Because anytime inflation becomes stubbornly high, that's going to push up long-term interest rates. And also the budget deficit. You know, clearly the country needs more infrastructure spending for bridges, the broadband access. But raising the budget deficit could also at some point tip the debt market such that borrowing cost rises. So the risk factor is really about higher mortgage rate, which will pull back first-time buyers. But even in that environment, I still see home prices remaining stable because we have this acute housing shortage.
I want to talk about input prices, before we go. Specifically, the price of lumber, we know it spiked to $1,600, crashed to $500. Maybe that's off the table. But any supply constraints that we're seeing, you know, with the automakers, they can't get their chips. Are homemakers able to get the supplies that they need in order to construct these homes?
You know, certainly there was a bit of speculation in the lumber prices, that big swing, as with, the, say, the cryptocurrency or other meme stocks. But now the lumber prices appears to have stabilized. It is still above the pre-pandemic levels. The one big concern is the potential number of construction workers. Right now, the builders want to ramp up. They're having difficulty trying to find qualified workers. So we need to assure that there is enough people go into vocation training. Infrastructure spending will also take away some of the construction workers into building highways. But we also need to think about building more homes, because without more home building, it could lead to another ramp up in home prices. And I don't think we want to see such a rapid increase. We just want to see moderate growth in the housing sector.
All right. Chief Economist with the National Association of Realtors, Lawrence Yoon, thanks so much. Let's chat about the return to school and the future of learning. We're joined now by Simon Allen, McGraw-Hill CEO, as well as Yahoo Finance's Julia LaRoche. Great to have you both here with us. So, Simon, let's just start with you. Now, McGraw-Hill over the last few years, I know, has increasingly pivoted more to the online learning and providing of online materials. I'm curious to know, especially as we are seeing students head back to the classroom in person, if you think, however, that online learning, frankly, might be here to stay even after the pandemic is over.
Yeah, it's a great question. We're actually very sure that online learning is going to be here. And I think you're going to see a hybrid future long term. I think a lot of schools and universities have really appreciated the flexibility and the efficiency levels, quite frankly, of teaching remotely. They have really spiked in the last year. It was a tough beginning, you know, the emergency of COVID that then put everyone at home. That was tough. I think then we worked with a lot of professors and school teachers around the world to get them onto our McGraw-Hill Connect and our Alex platforms. And in doing that, it's really helped the education process at every level. And we're finding now that well over three quarters actually of our teaching community are keen on using more digital material, not less. And that's why for McGraw-Hill, well over half of our business is digital. In fact, for the higher education group in the US, it's 82% is now digitally delivered. So it's here to stay, and it's going to grow.
And Simon, as you were saying, more than half of your total billings come from digital materials. And as you were just referencing that 82% figure here in the U.S., I do want to bring up digital and kind of the competition out there, if you will. And one of the things we were used to coming along was spending a lot of money on textbooks at the start of the semester. And now with these digital offerings, curious how you're thinking about pricing, but also against some of the competition out there. I'm thinking of Pearson recently rolling out a subscription service.
Yeah, good question. I would say, and you can see on screen, the average price now, the cost that students are spending on their higher education textbooks has come down significantly over the last decade, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years. What we've been able to do, Julia, is make sure that we can look at the flexible delivery of our products. So again, you think of our platform, you think of plain, if you like, ebook delivery all the way through the courseware with our Connect platform and our Alex platforms. There are different price points for students to select. And what we're finding is in the higher ed space especially, there is a big move towards the inclusive access model, which is a great affordability program that the US Department of Education initiated back in 2015. And students are able to utilize that program. It guarantees the lowest price from McGraw-Hill, and it gives the professor the key and the only they are the decision maker for the students, what the student wishes to purchase. That is critical, that relationship with the professor is so strong. Some of the other programs you've heard about recently on the subscription side, it's very much a B2C model. We have always believed in the power of the professor. She will determine the students that the students are going to buy, the particular products the students are going to buy. And we believe very strongly that through utilizing inclusive access, it keeps our price points down. We can afford to do that because it alleviates and removes what we call the gray space. If you remember when you were at school, Julia, the used books and some of the pirated products you may have seen, we're able to remove that segment from the market because we offer products at actually lower prices than used books would be. It means that our sell-through rates are growing significantly up into the 90 percentile plus, and that's sometimes 60% more than we would have seen 4 or 5 years ago. So we're very bullish about being affordable, about making sure we capture the sell-through rate for all of the class for the students, and to make sure we still focus on the professor, because it's the professor that really guides and directs the students on what to purchase.
Well, and then just taking a step back, I have to admit, I'm listening to this conversation, I'm a little bit on the outside. I graduated college decades ago. I don't have any kids, but I'm wondering, how have the digital tools developed over the pandemic? I heard horror stories when things began, especially with the younger kids trying to get their attention. Have the tools advanced considerably such that at least some kind of hybrid model where some students are at home, some students are at school, is that even viable, or are we just not there yet?
No, it is viable, and it's happening right now. We put, over $200 million a year into investments purely on our digital platforms, and it allows us to make sure that our platforms are very personalized. The word you may hear often is adaptive, and the phrase adaptive learning is key, and it really means that we are providing materials that are personalized for each student's learning journey. And it's that that drives the usability and the appreciation of our platforms. They're very, very involved now, the ability to track a student's performance, to correct them when they're going wrong before they go too wrong, and to make sure that we're able to give the teaching community, the teacher has the material they can see when a student is perhaps going down the wrong path and make corrective measures. So, and the student can direct their own learning at their pace. everything we produce, and you may remember us of old as a textbook company, we still have that great quality content. And that's critical when you think about our business. Then you marry that with the technology and the flexibility of our platforms. That's when you see the successes we're having. That's why our business is growing significantly this year. It's why we had a great 2020 and why we feel so good about the financial year ahead. It's all based upon our digital growth.
All right, we're going to leave that there. Simon Allen, CEO at McGraw-Hill, Yahoo Finance's Julia LaRoche, thank you both for joining us today.